Now, I think the audio on Zoom is okay, but I need the room people to let me know if my voice drops, okay? And it might take some vigorous waving, because once I, so feel free to even speak up if that occurs too. So, because I didn't appreciate how much, so much easier it was just to talk to Zoom, you know, and that's what I've been doing. And then it's like, okay. And I tried a different mask, so hopefully that'll come together. So this week we're going to talk about Vira Paramita, the Paramita of Vigor. But before we do that, I thought it would be worth talking about where we're at these days, because I was listening to people talking in the teas, and I'm kind of thinking about what happened when we were talking about Loon Lake and levels and COVID. And then I think I made reference to this Michigan podcast that seems to have a psychic connection with me, because when I listened the other day, it talked about exactly what was being expressed about energy levels waning, feeling exhausted, feeling tired, and what's going on. And hearing things like, you know, not being able to focus like I used to, slipping back into bad habits, you know, or habits I don't want to have, you know, and all of that kind of stuff coming together with this culture of ours that generally admires busyness, admires high energy, admires it, you know, to the point of, you sometimes wonder, you know, in this sort of badge of honor, you know, where I don't know how many times, you know, you're like, I'm so busy, and they have these schedules and people are filling out stuff, you know, and then we have advertising, just do it, you know, and Fitbits to measure everything and apps to measure some more things and bigger, better, faster, smarter. And then we have all our technology that's kind of adding to it that, you know, there was a time, some of you are old enough to remember, when the phone rang and you just chose to answer it or not. But you tended to, because you tended to think it was an emergency, but you didn't worry about like taking a message or, you know, on an answering machine and checking all of that. Didn't have things, you know, but then we got pagers and then we got flip phones and then we got more and more stuff. And so work and home life start to blur. And getting into that point of the analogy that I kind of think of is, you know, I'm too busy driving to stop and fill up for gas, you know, and how much we're filling up our time. And then instead of going from 0 to 100, like most of the time, we went from 0 to 100, boom, with the pandemic. And that really set us on our butts a little bit with lots of, you know, well, of course, we went through denial, you know, because what was that really happening? Lots of confusion with mixed messages, lots of fear. Then we were told to go home, which is, you know, for some is okay, for some is not. We had all of the economic consequences of either working too much because you're essential service, not working at all because you're deemed unessential, you know, and everything, all the rules of the game changed. And, you know, and then you sort of have these vague feelings of what's happening to me. And then, like I said, old Wisconsin's, you know, it's sort of reiterating, you know, kind of, you know, suggestions of like, you know, it's not so much the individual little tasks that, you know, I can't get done. It's the collection of the little individual tasks, you know, and just conjuring up the effort to do that. Another thing they talked about was, you know, on the technology, you know, we built up this being yoked to our screens so we can't even put them down, you know. And surge capacity was brought up, you know, in that beautiful mechanism for dealing with short-term disasters and how we get, you know, people got really busy and organized and got their microphones and their Zooms and everything else, but that's designed for short term. And so what are we, 8 months later? And we're still, some people are still surging, you know. So, and then people on the discussion was talking about, you know, craving solitude. And actually, this was a really good definition of solitude as being freedom from other people's minds. And they were referencing like TV and podcasts and even music, like just this whole feeling, you know, and having this sort of sense of despair, like I just want to sit and knit, you know, which is also interesting. And the sort of the North American versus Asian definitions of energy and happiness and terms, and that was worth noting too. Whereas North America, we define happiness as high intensity and high intensity positive words. It's excitement, thrill, push, push. Whereas this is our main, apparently it's a study in the Asian cultures. It's their low intensity positive words for happiness, which are like calm, peaceful, and serene. So I just wanted to acknowledge that, because when you're about to embark on a discussion about vigor, not one of my strong paramitas ever, you know, so it's like, well, how do we talk about that, you know, without sounding, you know, kind of, you know, like overly ambitious. And so everything's going to be kind of framed around that thought process, right? So that you don't feel bad at the end of it. That's the idea. Okay. Including myself, because like I said, it's not one of my strong points for a variety of reasons. So we'll carry on because, you know, this is part of the curriculum. So we're still going to talk about the paramitas. And then hopefully it kind of will kind of adjust it accordingly. So in, I liked Reb Anderson's kind of introduction about vigor, zeal. In Japan, to be a Zen person has been described as being a vigorously jumping fish. And it's kapatsupatsu. Sorry, Kate and Michael, which is apparently a amapatamita for a sound of a fish, joyfully jumping and splashing in water. And I gather koi fish do this a lot. Like when I kind of tried to Google a couple of images, I couldn't find a good one. A lot of the questions came up was, why are my koi jumping? So it's like, you know, it's an image. So, and then from that word is it's often translated as lively, active, and vigorous. So, and as you know, I've been borrowing off of lots of different writers. Like I kind of chuckled to myself when Kate and Michael said the only book they had was Aikens when they did their first time on this. And I'm like, oh, and he's not an easy read either. So, but he's sort of on the more traditional, you know, virile. Michael talked about this, but some of our other authors talk about the perfection of enthusiasm, engaging effort, zeal, lots of other definitions. Aiken does talk about, you know, a Chinese translation, Qing Qin, which means the advancement of single-minded spiritual vigor. So it's sort of interesting. But I think we all kind of get the kind of their historical roots about the language and things like that. We've been talking about the six paramitas, and one of the things that is emphasized or pointed out that when we get to virya, this is kind of a classic pivot point on the paramitas, whereby the first three, generosity, morality, and tolerance, are pretty much practices for anybody. And it's been described that they don't necessarily require a profound sense of selfishness. People might do them just because they're trying to get brownie points, merit points, fear of karmic, you know, consequences. But that it is suggested that the final three energy, meditation, and wisdom operate at a higher level of spiritual awareness and tended to be the focus of monks and nuns who give priority in their lives to spiritual practice. I've been having fun with some of the older texts here. So we have one here, Nagarjuna. Moreover, giving, moral virtue, and patience produce the peace, security, and happiness associated with great merit. Now, however, one wishes to advance beyond this so that one might develop marvelously supreme jhana, absorption, and wisdom. This is analogous to digging a well. When one has already discovered wet mud, one then adds the increased effort, for one has just then experienced a definite hope that the water will be found. And there's some other ones too. It's like, you know, starting a fire, you know, and you get it going. And when it's starting, you don't give up, you know, you just keep it because, you know, it just isn't going to work. And so they talk about characteristics, features of vigor. So in regard to endeavors, there's an attitude that you'll succeed to doing this. And that when you take it up this paramita, there's no difficulty. One's determinations and intentions are solid and strong. One's mind is freed from weariness. And whatever is engaged is carried out to the end. So we'll hear. Now, when I read this, what shortly followed was a story. I'm going to read the story because I think it's a great story. So, oh yeah, this is the handbook of the six perfections. It's three. It looks worse than it is because it's in three languages, but just by the way. And this is Nagarjuna. I don't know how to say it. That's why I only speak English. I can't pronounce anything else. So they're talking about the marks of vigor consist in the body and mind not resting. This is illustrated by Shakyamuni Buddha in a previous life when he was the leader of a group of merchants. He led the merchants into a precipitous and difficult place. There happened to be a Rakshasa ghost there who blocked their way, holding up his hands and saying, "You must stop, don't move, I will not permit you to go." The leader of the merchants then hit the ghost with his right fist. The fist immediately stuck to the ghost such that he was unable to pull it away. Next, he hit it with his left fist and was also unable to pull it away. Oh, by the way, this type of ghost is a man-eating ghost or person-eating ghost. Next, he hit it. Yeah, we said it, he kicked him with his right foot and it too became stuck. Next, he kicked it with his left foot, and the same thing happened. He used his head to butt it, whereupon it immediately became stuck as well. The ghost then asked, "Now that you are in this fix, what do you propose to do next? Has your mind given up or not?" He replied, "Although I continue to be bound up in these five ways, my mind will never be forced by you to cease its determination. I will use the power of vigor to carry on the fight with you. I am determined not to retreat." The ghost then felt delighted and thought, "This man's really got guts." He then told the man, "Your power of vigor is immense. You are someone who definitely will not give up. I'll turn you loose and allow you to leave." So, and I don't know who's in this crowd. Monty Python. Yeah, you don't Google it. It's pretty. It'll remind you of this. You know, it's the night fighting, and I can still do it. Anyhow, it makes you wonder where they got this story. Anyhow, I thought it was so good, I had to tell that story. I just, you know, and it's in time for Halloween too. So anyhow. So unlike that, we're not going to go that far, that's for sure. And we're not likely to encounter these ghosts anytime soon, hopefully. So the purpose of the paramita is for the sake of generating and refreshing and maintaining vigor in our practice. And though maybe patience may have plugged up some of the holes where energy may drain, we start looking at aspiration as a source of energy. And then we definitely need enthusiasm, vigorous enthusiasm, for the practices of liberation, the Bodhisattva path. And by clarifying and studying our attention through heroic effort, this is Rev. Anderson, it brings us more energy and commitment for practice. All of the six paramitas help care for aspirations, but we definitely need to rest and refuel. Diane Rosetto talks about this paramita, inviting us to explore the difference between doing and engaging. Engaging capacity for perseverance, determination, and wholeheartedness. And using the right effort, not to be pushed, not to be a quick fix, one step forward. Using the analogy of a koan, go straight on a narrow road with 99 curves. Agreed, the life's road is windy and sometimes narrow and sometimes easy, but to walk that narrow part with the 99 turns takes a particular type of effort. And it's more about engaging fully with living. So the texts do talk about kind of sequencing, and there's variations on the theme and things like that, but it's sort of, my analogy was more kind of like deciding to go on a trip or deciding to which career or something like that, that there's steps that you do that drive you. And that, I don't know about you, but when I don't have some of these steps, I just end up in a kind of a ambivalent zone, neither going or, you know, like it. I've always personally said, you know, once you make a decision, it doesn't matter what the decision is, at least you have some direction, right? But until you do that, you're kind of stuck. The analogy there would be until your attitude or you have a vow or an intention that's fairly well defined, it's pretty hard to proceed forward. So we go, vows being defined as an engine that drives human aspiration, advancement, and accomplishment. But it also supports us in a basic contradiction that we cannot fulfill our vows completely, especially the Bodhisattva ones. But we do it anyhow. And it's not really an obstacle, but just a path or a gateway to meet life with an open heart, clear seeing, and return to a commitment to waking up and doing what we can. The function of vow is to bring us over and over to face ourselves, not to judge or berate ourselves, but to meet ourselves squarely, meeting our humanness with curiosity, openness, and love. So vow is to live in accord with aspiration. And once you make that, all the paramitas protect and sustain it. And there's also here a little side tip thing that it's also not to be done alone. This is true. It's also sort of a cosmic call for help. And so we do this through steady practice. We reflect. In joyful practice, we reflect on how good it is to act in accord with our aspirations. We're not trying to get joy through our practice. Our practice is joy. And Norman adds about intention and vision. We can't make or take vows. We can only practice them. And it changes your priorities. So the next part, or the step, for lack of a better term, is, and that you talk a lot about, is courage. And I guess it's the same thing. Once you make your decision, have to have enough courage or strength to go forth with it. And it's a fundamental component of the Buddhist perfection of energy. This is Dale Wright. We also have the Arya Sutra defines the perfection of energy as striving without weariness, and the practice of good as striving untouched by the fault of discouragement. It's a movement out of mental slackness, focuses on the thought of enlightenment is the most potent technique available to raise a practitioner out of lassitude and into a level of energy that can sustain ardent practicing discipline. How is this done? And then, well, Houston, we have a problem. So, and this is right. He's like, he didn't say that, but that there's a lot of weaknesses in the text on very little way of technique, that it's mostly inspirational, the raw, you know, challenges that are put forth, dramatic tales of Mara. That's actually, it's fascinating. I mean, it's a fairly healthy part of the text, and they spend like this huge amount of stuff about various types of hells and the roads. So, you know, here there's human, the usual we've heard of, the great living hells, the great black line hells, the great unification hells, the screaming and great screaming hells, the hot and greatly hot hells, the blazing flame hells, the eight cold ice hells, the boiling, burning forest, sharp road of sharp knives, etc., etc. I haven't read them all. So they spend a lot of time in using those as the analogies for courage. So, again, like I said, I really needed to put a rock drop. We're not going there. Like, we're just not going there. Instead, it's a, you know, yeah, we'll go with Norman's. Courage isn't fearlessness, it's the opposite. Facing fear, going into it and through it. Takes courage simply to be a normal person at ease in the world among us. We're all vulnerable and we all face risks. And so that's the courage that we're kind of, you know, looking at, you know, and what we're facing and what we're looking for energy for. So the courage in the face of despair and loss, you know, things that are beyond our control, you know, and when we lose our capacity to get up and out of it. Looking at strategies of self-protection, willing to give up instead of facing it, which is, you know, unfortunately that's happening. Encourage to say no situations which would not be advisable to encourage the practice of energy. Just putting some boundaries around that, which can take some courage, can take a lot of courage, sometimes it takes more courage. And then courage to ask for help, that we've seen or training for someone already well endowed with this capacity, and seek their advice. And so the final component is responsibility, and accepting responsibility and ownership of our lives. It's like once you've decided and you've gone through it, you own it, you know, and that, and we meet it with the needs. This is Diane, where it's like feeding the baby. The need is clear and you meet it. The stopping at the sound of the distant temple bell. So the usual focus is to present a way to stop a bell that, in our usual way of thinking, is far out of reach. But for this discussion, it focuses on hearing and listening to the bell itself. You can't stop the sound of the bell unless we hear it. And we can't hear it unless we put forth the effort to train our ears to listen. Bells call us to action. We summon to gather energy, make effort. It's an invitation we choose to accept. And for most of us, we have many bells ringing for us every second of the day. And the collective of all of these steps, the way I'm interpreting, is it gives you integrity so that you're not divided against yourself. When it's present, you're open to everything, good or bad. And joyful effort is integrity, being in tune with your whole self and connection to others and receiving from the whole by way of your unique place in it, the energy takes it to further the whole. This is Norman talking about Dogen's explanation. alignment of one's words with one's deeds, walking the talk. Nothing saps energy more than deception, deceiving self, and worse, and others, and deceiving yourself. And it helps with the total presence in everything you do. When you practice like this, you will have lots of energy, and others will be inspired to practice this way themselves. Maybe later. So there's obviously different types of energy, and they're divided up to the obvious ones, physical and mental. And there's lots of talk about the mental energy. Wright talks about this, about mental strength was considered the primary task for the bodhisattva. And that was cultivated by the thought of enlightenment for others, for self and others, working successfully on behalf of others, working effortlessly without any thought about their own effort or their own labor. But I kind of like, sort of we're looking back at how you do this, kind of responding back to courage and using that on mental energy that says, look at what we're doing and exploring what makes us vulnerable. When we're experiencing a strong emotion, we might take on the practice of just experiencing the energy behind the thoughts about that emotion. When experiencing frustration or anger, we can use the paramita of engaging effort to turn tension from the accompanying thoughts, such as, it's his fault I feel this way, or she's the one who caused this mess. I'm obviously shining toward these passages because behind every emotion, there's a physical sensation. And by making the effort to turn our attention toward that sensation rather than avoiding it, we can come to know it wholeheartedly in a way that is open and free. No one can do this for us. Engaging situations and conditions of our lives, meeting our fears and resistances, keeping on with it and not turning back, doing our very best. This is the paramita of engaging effort. So we know the importance of emotions. We know how they can be detrimental. But we also know that emotions can be shaped and cultivated. They can be educated. They can be explored. And we can have feelings of compassionate choices and actions. And even though any particular emotional response is involuntary, the conditions that give rise to all emotions are subject to meditative cultivation. So that's Wright talking. So we'll be looking at that later on. And then the most important part is the attitude we take. So we have and then the other energy comes from our physical selves. This is right. Although one would assume this has to do with diet, exercise, and bodily practices such as yoga and a variety of practices that might have been available in early India, texts do not specify what would have been included in this list, except for what he suggested there. And this tendency to make a distinction between physical and mental as separate entities, and rather than one informing the other, would be what I would be saying. And though energy is not a thing we can place our hands on, it does manifest itself as power or strength. So I'm kind of, this whole, what he talks about, vitality and optimal functioning and the energy. And if you read Norman, the energy bunny and that sort of unrelenting energy that goes on. But we do, like I said, know that if you've got mental states that are wearisome, depression, sadness, it's going to affect your physical state. if your physical state's not cared for, it's going to affect your mental state. So that's kind of what I'm kind of hoping we're doing in this series, actually, on that and how we work with all of that. Because it doesn't mean that, how do I put this? We certainly know lots of people that are highly energetic mentally, but maybe physically not so energetic, and vice versa, right? So it's just sort of that whole balance. The one thing they do talk about with the energy, especially the body, and it's also mental, is taking on too much. And so we're, you know, so the next thing is sort of more about overdoing and underdoing. And especially in the overdoing, and what I've said before with busyness and all of that stuff that goes with it, it's held in high regard and it becomes kind of addictive for a lot of people to the point where they can't stop. Right? So not good. We're not talking about that. And that in itself turns into a source of suffering. And so they talk in the text a lot about the whole desire of energy and making things that, making conclusions that can be conceived that you're getting this energy, it will be an outcome of the discipline and practice. And that's a natural consequence. So I just work hard enough at it, I'm going to have lots of energy. Say goodbye to Martha, everybody. We won't point her out. You know, and that, you know, resisting the image of a joyless disciplinarian, one who stifles all inclination and preference in order to fulfill the demands of duty. And I think Michael talked about this, you know, the kind of the gritted teeth kind of energy, and that's not what we're going for. So the other part is the opposite thing and the term laziness. No, I didn't really like that one because, well, and a few people, other people don't too, because I think it's like, I think it's such a, well, it's such a negative term, and I think we get it, you know, the, you know, slothfulness and all that, but especially in our culture, you know, we're so pushed against it. And the most I would say about laziness is if I think I'm terming that for myself, what is it trying to tell me? It's just information. If I'm actually using that term. Both Reb and Norman talked, though, about kind of sneakier forms of laziness, which I thought were kind of fun and interesting. So things like not knowing when you've done enough. It's easier to continue something than to stop. It becomes mindless. Or not stopping when it's appropriate, which leads to mistakes, fatigue, grumpiness. Rushing over work is a deep-seated avoidance of what we most need to address in our lives, in that form of addiction thing. You know, people that are just busy for the sake of being busy, and they just come up with umpteen dozen things to do, and you just want them to sit down, like for a minute, you know, or the rest of your life, you know. Other forms of laziness are taking on things that are too advanced, which I think, and I think maybe that's that whole like shortcutting thing, you know, like taking a half day retreat instead of a full shasheen if you haven't had any previous experience. And all of these things that are kind of set up to maybe by taking on too much, then you're going to maybe have to quit and you can't fulfill. Not asking for advice. Another one, you know, like maybe, you know, we avoid asking for advice because we don't want to hear something different. And then Norman talks about discouragement and self-doubt, other forms of it. But it's also attitudes that you can give into easily and assuming we might unwittingly make things worse. He talks about the ultimate source of laziness and our semi-blind view of our lives. So the end of your life is going to come much sooner than you think. What? How did this happen? I barely begun. It's gone so quickly. You look at your relatives gazing at your sad, diminished body, nodding their heads sadly, and you won't know what to say. Being human is precious. What a shame you are frittering it away. That's about as harsh as we'll get on that. Like I said, I think things are tough enough. But I think there's a few kind of compass points that are might be useful that I just sort of gleaned and labeled it accordingly. And Aiken sort of talks about this as, you know, the two typical problems that people come about very often. What should I do if it's not well developed? And how should I maintain virya in the workaday world with all its demands and distractions? And virya, like patience, like sincerity, like inquiry, like samadhi, builds with practice. So as I'm going to try, Yasutani Hiroshi would say, 5% is enough to start with. If you have enough vitality and stick-to-itiveness to sit through 25 minutes of zazen, then you have quite a lot of spiritual zeal. Nailed it! Just so we all know. The human being by nature's inadequate practices of zazen, inadequately practices zazen, and inadequately realizes its true nature. And inadequately, this is Vira Parmita, on how we learn to persevere like a small child determined to learn how to walk while continually falling down, or like a very old person getting up in the middle of the night, lurching from wall to wall to reach the bathroom. And so his answer to finding your way through distractions is to go back to two things to ask. What is my purpose here and who is in charge? I like that. That's a nice little munchable nugget on. So you can forget all of everything I said before. And you can just do that. What's my purpose and who's in charge? Or I know some of you in the addictions, who's driving the bus? You know, and just sort of giving back some control to the situation to yourself. I do like, though, in Wright, where using effort, paramita effort, as an ethical term in energy. And then, of course, we usually equate it to Aristotle, Newton, as a physics term. But he looks at it as an ethical term, a metaphor for how human beings ought to be, and that our culture lacks a common term for the energy of human spiritedness. And so there was two things that how you can reflect on how you might fall short in life. One is to be a negative force, which is acting unjustly, committing crimes and things. Most people can manage that, a lot of people. But the other one was to fail in the positive. And the second failure signals the deficiency of energy in that it's a lack of constructive striving towards something worthwhile. I thought that was really interesting. It's just like, just changes it, you know, the tone of it. And the worthwhile, and obviously beyond, it's not the worthwhileness of I'm going to get a bigger, better house. You know, it's the worthwhileness that we practice, you know, and be beyond ourselves. So it takes effort in everything that we do. We take care of ourselves physically, emotionally, spiritually. We eat the right food. We try and exercise. And what we're looking at is effortless effort in all conditions. And if you're sick or injured, that's how you practice. You practice as a sick person. I think most of us would know this one, Master Mazu. Lying in bed, reduced state, helplessness. How is your health today? Sun-faced Buddha. Moon-faced Buddha is the answer. Sun-faced Buddha figures Buddhas who live for eons in full strength. Moon-faced Buddha, cool, quiet Buddhas who live for a day and a night. And yes, I'm a wreck, but I am a Buddha wreck. Whatever condition I am in is the perfect condition. In any condition I have, what I have, what I need to practice joyful effort to be a bodhisattva in the appropriate form and style to fit the occasion. Actually put a conclusion in. I remember this from my study. I always would just crap out at the end and it just would stop. I've done enough. I made an effort to put a conclusion in. So this whole energy, you know, that we do know, energy levels come and go. They're rarely stable. And when it's easy, when our energy levels are high, that we might make the mistake of pushing too far. But it's a lot harder when your energy levels are low and our low state of spirit. Anything we do requires energy, whether it's positive or negative. It accomplishes many things. It makes us restless, jumping from one thing to another. But it needs direction. It needs to be used effectively. It takes energy to do both. It takes energy to overcome one's instincts. So, Norman, in order to keep up with the work, bodhisattvas practice the perfection of joyful effort. It's impossible to be a bodhisattva without lots of energy. But it's dual in nature. On one hand, it's realistic practice with our troubles, flaws, and limitations. And on the other hand, at the same time, we're constantly working on our bodhisattva commitment. And this is Kama. Determination gets us started, but energy keeps us going. And this sort of notion of well-directed energy is that's the last thought of that. Okay. So we'll go into our next part here that we've been doing, and I will continue to do to the bitter end, even though I'm not sure. Some days I wonder, how did I get started on this? But I'm going to continue on this pattern. I've reached my pivot point. I'm over halfway there. So, but we are going to do, I'm just teasing, our sense exercise and go through this. And so I invite you all out there to get yourself comfy, turn off your screens, turn down your lights, get warm if you're cold, open the window if you're hot. And we're going to settle for a few minutes and see what we can do with this paramita. So this just offered to you to give you a different perspective to your practice. And everything that I offer for you is optional. You can participate fully or not at all. So if you're on Zoom, you can turn off your sound and do something else. If you're in the room, you can tune me out. You know. It's not intended to take any deep dives, just merely to introduce and explore. And it is possible because I'm asking you to consciously relax and settle more than we might have experienced in a usual Zazen posture. It could open you up. You may get some sensations that are uncomfortable. But please only stay with what you find to be comfortable. You are in charge and in control of all that is off. I forgot my bell. Just to grab the little, yeah, the condo thing. It doesn't matter. Just something I can think at the time. Thanks. I knew I forgot. Thank you. That's okay. So we'll just take a few minutes of settling. I'll offer some suggestions for awareness based on the paramita. And there'll be just a chance to reflect on what the body informs you. You can take any position that will give you the greatest amounts of ease. Your eyes can be open or closed. lying down with your legs reclined on a bolster or on a chair or on your back, knees bent, supported by each other. Maybe a small cushion to support your head so that your neck is resting in a neutral position. But lying on your side, with your head supported with a pillow or small or your arm. Or it might be classic Zazen position. Choose and give yourself permission to pick the most comfortable position possible. And as you settle into your position and as your body begins to ease, you may choose to take a cleansing type breath and then deep breath in and a deep breath out. Another deep breath in and a deep breath out. If you choose, just find a breath pattern that is calm and comfortable for you. And just take a few moments and a few cycles of breath in your own way. For your consideration, begin to be aware of the points of your body that are in contact with your cushion, your seat, the soles of your feet on the floor, your back against your chair, your knees touching, hands in your lap or on the floor. Just notice the pressures along any point of contact. And if there's nothing to notice, that's fine too. And as you begin to notice, is there any part of you that could ease just a little bit more? Perhaps just 10% more. Can you allow the earth to receive you and support you as you melt further into relaxation? As you settle in ease, can you be fully present in the sensation of engaged rest? You might perhaps consider and notice your breath pattern. Perhaps a counted in-breath and a counted out-breath that's a little longer. Gentle, non-forced. In, two, three, out, two, three, four. In, two, three, out, two, three, four. In, two, three, out, two, three, four. And for a few more cycles of breath, you could continue with this pattern or one of your choosing, shorter, longer, the same, or just a regular breath. Perhaps you may consider imagining your breath moving into parts of your body that may need a little more stillness, a little more kindness, a little more nourishment. The invitation will be to just stay in this place of rest, a place of joyful regeneration, of joyful refueling, of joyful ease. And maybe you might reflect on a situation where joyful effort most expresses itself for you. A situation where you may have felt a sense of self-generating energy or a sense of invigorated serenity. Or where maybe you were in a flow state where time has no meaning. Effortless effort. A poem by Kabir Patel. Dear you, you who always have so many things to do, so many places to be, your mind spinning like fan blades at high speed, each moment always a blur because you're never still. I know you're tired. I also know it's not your fault. The constant brain buzz is like a swarm of bees threatening to sting. You close your eyes. You've forgotten something again. You need to prepare for this or that. You should have done that before. What if you closed your eyes? Would the world fall apart without you? Or would your mind become the open sky flock of thoughts flying across the sunrise? As you just watched and smiled. Dear you, you who always have so many things to do, so many places to be, your mind spinning like fan blades at high speed, each moment always a blur because you're never still. I know you're tired. I also know it's not your fault. The constant brain buzz is like a swarm of bees threatening to sting if you close your eyes. You've forgotten something again. You need to prepare for that or else. You should have done that differently. What if you closed your eyes? Would the world fall apart without you? Or would your mind become the open sky flock of thoughts flying across the sunrise as you just watched and smiled. So we'll just start slowly coming back, something a little more alert. Move your hands and your feet. Zoomers can come back or not. Little stretch, little yawn. So we have a combination of things. Consider maybe or not, but obviously the most part of that is just, is there anything you can later take and incorporate into your practice, anything that will inform your day-to-day? I actually really would like you to do this one for sure. I'm thinking about those jumping koi, and I'm like, what is your image or sound of joyful effort? Mine is sparrows vigorously swishing and fluffing their feathers in their little carved out dust bath bowls. That's the one that comes to mind for me. Maybe this week you'll reflect on what joyful or engaged rest means for you. Maybe you plan a day without an agenda, much beyond coffee and a good book. Or you fully indulged in sleeping in, or even better, slept until you naturally woke up. Or when you actually realize what you really needed was a nap, and you take one, even for a minute. A couple out of Norman that might appeal. I've modified a couple of them though. Sit for 10 minutes once or twice a day and practice slow, deep breathing. Try to heal and calm yourself with each breath. Pay attention to your diet, exercise. Now, he said like an hour a day, so that's part of it. But I said preferably outdoors. Be on the lookout for non-replenishing states of mind, such as dullness, discouragement, low motivation. And when such states of mind arise, note them and practice stopping, breathing, and saying to yourself, I am a precious human being like everyone else. I've been given this life for a reason. So I thank you for your time and being here. We'll close with our chant and then we'll go to the service.
And the chant is on page 3 of the chant book under yours, Avatar.
We'll go ahead.